WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. India is one of the countries being torn apart by religious fighting. Thousands of Hindu extremists destroyed a Muslim mosque in Ayodhya, India, on Sunday. A gang of Hindu militants turned on the journalists who were covering the story. My guest, Edward Gargan, is one of the reporters who was beaten up. Hundreds of people have been killed across India in the days of rioting that have followed the mosque's destruction. The mosque was built in 1528. The Hindu militants believe that it was built on the spot where the Hindu god Ram was born 5,000 years ago. They want to erect a Hindu temple there. We called Edward Gargan earlier today in New Delhi. He's been covering South Asia for the New York Times for the past year and a half. Fundamentalist Hindu leaders had called on Hindus from around the country to gather in Ayodhya on Sunday to destroy the mosque and build a Hindu temple.
Originally, the mosque, people felt, was not going to be destroyed. The Supreme Court had issued some orders that said, you know, you can't touch the mosque. You can hold prayers and you can chant and sing and do these religious observances at the site. About 30 minutes or slightly more, maybe 40 minutes before the auspicious moment, which was determined astrologically, before the sadhus, these holy men, were supposed to begin the praying and chanting, a large number, and it's obviously difficult in the chaos to determine, maybe a couple of thousand of well-armed, and by well-armed I mean with clubs and swords and hammers, Hindu thugs, I suppose you would call them, real vicious militant Hindu young men came charging through the scene toward the mosque and began scaling this rather rickety pipe and barbed wire fence. And in a matter of moments, many of them were over the fence and on top of the domes. There were three domes that this mosque had. And smashing away with these little pocket sledgehammers, these handheld sledgehammers, short-handled sledgehammers, and chips of the dome were flying all over the place. And it was obviously well planned, but it happened without many of the crowd knowing. I mean, there was a huge crowd, perhaps 100,000 people. It was very difficult to tell, spread out over a very large area. And the leadership of this religious movement was speaking from a building some distance away and communicating via loudspeakers, you know, urging people to chant and things like this. And they did not evidently have control over this group of Hindus, or at least some of the leaders did not have control over the young militants who stormed the mosque.
So here's this 16th century mosque that was getting torn down with hammers and clubs.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, steel pipes and they clearly had some sense of how to go about doing what they were doing. And although we now have learned that several of them were buried under the rubble when the domes collapsed, it was the word that sort of leaps to mind when you think about what I saw there was frenzy. I mean, there was an absolute frenzy of activity. It was like a scene from a movie in which sharks are frothing at fish in the water. I mean, it was just, they devoured this mosque.
Where did you position yourself within this crowd of 100,000 people as you watched the mosque get destroyed?
Well, the 100,000 people were not in front of the mosque. I mean, the area in front of the mosque was somewhat restricted access. I mean, most people were on this huge field and on this sort of slightly hilly embankment spread out. I suppose the equivalent might be something like the sheep meadow in Central Park. And then off to one side is the mosque on a little hill surrounded by this fence. And the area in which the Hindus want to build this huge temple to Ram included the mosque plus another nearly 3 acres adjacent to the mosque. And in that area, there was somewhat restricted access. There were holy men and there were Hindu activists and Hindu leaders, but the main sort of chanting and speaking was some distance away. When they attacked the mosque, the press corps, not only the foreign press corps, but the Indian, our Indian colleagues, were more or less scattered around the front of the mosque, and these guys charged through us as they went to the mosque. Some of the press was on top of a building that was about 30 yards away facing the mosque, a four-story building. And so we were in a very good position to see what was happening. I mean, it was, to watch the people climb over the fences to, you know, see them start hammering on the dome. And, I mean, I simply stood on this platform that had been built, this sort of cement platform, and just simply took notes and watched this process as it transpired.
How did the mob start to turn on the journalists?
Never in my recollection had journalists been really attacked in India. And so despite the frenzy of these guys attacking the mosque, generally we felt pretty safe. But the evening before, one of the Hindu leaders had made a virulent speech against the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, accusing it of derogatory comments about the Hindus and the Hindu militants and the work they intended to do in building this temple. In fact, the BBC made no such comment, but it inflamed the passions of many of the Hindus, and a German television crew had been beaten up the night before on the mistaken belief by the people who beat them up and damaged their equipment that they were the BBC. That was Saturday evening. Then we are now back to Sunday afternoon, Sunday about noon. And so these guys are whacking away at the dome. Chips of the dome are flying, and the crowd is screaming, "Jai Shri Ram, Hail Lord Ram, Victory to Lord Ram." And almost on a cue, it was hard to say. It didn't seem spontaneous. It seemed very well organized. Suddenly, they attacked all of us, almost all at once. And my experience was that a colleague from the Los Angeles Times was standing a little bit distant from me, named Bob Drogan, and some of these young hooligans started to attack him. And I thought, this is crazy. What are they doing to him? And I tried to intervene. And then the next thing I knew, I had been sort of whacked by something from behind and was sort of down on the ground, a little bit stunned and trying to figure out, well, what's going on here, because it was so unexpected. So I can't actually tell you what precipitated the attack on us, but it happened very, very suddenly.
How badly were you beaten?
I have bruises on my back and leg. Not as badly as many other people at all. And I was slightly dazed when I sort of found myself behind what tiny, tiny police line there was. But a colleague from the Voice of America was brought behind this little police line with blood streaming down his face, and his shirt was soaked. And I immediately snapped out of my daze because he is not only a colleague but a very close friend, Peter Heinlein from the Voice of America. And he had been clubbed unconscious. He had actually gone into the mosque while it was being demolished, and he was attacked in there. He was hit apparently from behind by a club. And so I did what anyone would do in that situation, is you are concerned about the welfare of your colleagues and friends. And so I had my notes stolen from me anyway, so nothing made any difference at this point. But I focused on getting Peter out of the area, first addressing his headroom, but sort of bathing his face off and trying to see what we could do about the cut, which was not much except put water on a handkerchief and hold it so that the blood stopped, because he lost quite a bit of blood, and try to get him out of the area. And we went through the back door of a Hindu temple down a field and managed to escape the scene.
Well, when you were beaten, your glasses flew off your head, and I think some of the other guys who were beating you stepped on your glasses. Now, anyone who wears glasses like I do knows what a real nightmare that is. I mean, that's like one of your worst fears. You're in a troubled situation, and then you won't be able to see. Can you see without your glasses?
The answer is I can't see that well without my glasses. But I did actually providentially bring a second pair of glasses with me, which I didn't remember for about 10 minutes. But I did actually turn out to have a second pair of glasses with me. I often travel with two pairs. Not that I expect to be mugged, but I expect to lose them.
How come there weren't more police or even military to protect the mosque and to protect the people there?
Well, the town in which this occurred is a town called Ayodhya. And Ayodhya is in a state called Uttar Pradesh. And Uttar Pradesh government, the state government, is controlled by a political party called the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is one of the Hindu fundamentalist parties. And so that party, obviously, they came to power on the promise that they would build this massive temple to this god Ram. And so they were absolutely intent that there should be no injuries to any of the Hindus who came to pray and to do the symbolic construction, which is what the Supreme Court had dictated they could do, the symbolic construction of this temple. And so there were no police about. The government had formally promised the Supreme Court that there would be no damage to the mosque. And so even though I think in their heart of hearts, and as we now know, in fact, is the case, the government was delighted that the mosque came down. That government's been subsequently replaced by the central government.
How's your friend Peter Heinlein of Voice of America?
He's quite well, actually. He's, he was obviously somewhat shaken up. We flew back to Delhi that night. We were fortunate enough to get the flight back. We got all... And he has 20 stitches in the back of his head and has a large white bandage wrapped around him, so it looks really severe. But he's in good spirits and has been working, I think, as hard as the rest of us have.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Gargan. He's joining us from New Delhi. He's the New York Times correspondent based in India. He covers South Asia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the phone is Edward Gargan, who covers India for the New York Times. So you're in Delhi now?
I'm in New Delhi at the moment, right, yeah.
And is there a curfew there?
Parts of the city are under curfew. The parts of the city are the Muslim sections of the city. And I went out today into those areas of the city. And it's the old part of the city, the old walled city, an area called Chandi Chowk. And if any of your listeners have been to Delhi and Chandi Chowk, they know it is this unbelievably teeming, crowded, swarming, noisy, the smells of food being cooked area where it's very difficult to move along, to weave through the crowds. Today it was totally empty. There wasn't a soul on the street except for the police and the odd cow wandering down the empty streets. It was the most amazing thing you can see. And police had ordered everyone who, and in this case it happens to be Muslims, everyone to remain indoors. They cannot go out to buy food. They cannot go out to go to the mosque. They cannot go out to do anything. And so in those sections of the city where the Delhi police and the Delhi government believed that anger could explode in some sort of violence, and it is the Muslims, of course, who are enraged at the destruction of the mosque, those are the areas that are under curfew here in Delhi.
What else is the government doing to stop further violence and to stop further destruction of the mosque?
Very little is the unfortunate answer. I mean, they do actually have quite a number of police and security forces, of what they call paramilitary forces, around the country. But the death toll is rising at about 200 and some odd a day. Every day, 200 or so people seem to be killed. A large number of them are Muslims who are fired at by police, Muslims who may be either demonstrating or trying to firebomb a Hindu temple or throw rocks. The security forces have been opening fire on Muslim crowds, and the large number of victims have been Muslims. There have also been battles between Muslims and Hindus in some cases, and there were reports coming in of Hindus attacking Muslim mosques, attacking Muslim shops, throwing firebombs in Muslim homes. There is a tremendous amount of tension at the moment, and the death toll is a reflection of that. But the government itself seems unable to stop it completely. I mean, India is an enormous country, 880 million people, and obviously the police and the security forces can't be everywhere. I should also point out that you know, the vast majority of India's security forces are Hindus who don't have any particular love for Muslims anyway. So it's difficult to tell, because India's press self-censors itself, exactly what is genuinely going on at this moment. We will find out in the next, as the weeks pass, we will get a very clear picture of what actually happened. But day to day, because we don't have that many people to go around the country, we do not know exact dimensions, and we do not know who is being killed and why.
When India was partitioned in 1947 and Pakistan was created, India was to be a secular state. Do the Hindu fundamentalists want India to become a Hindu state?
Yeah, that is their essential program for what they see happening to India in the future. They, for rhetorical purposes, it seems, describe Hinduism no longer as a religion, but as a definition of nationality. And in this rather unusual definition, they include Muslims as Hindus, necessarily. But when you push them in interviews somewhat more strongly, the more rabid Hindus among them will say, listen, we're surrounded by fundamentalist Islamic states. You know, we've got Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran. I mean, even Bangladesh, they say, is becoming fundamentalist. I mean, here we are, the majority, the persecuted majority in our own country. You know, we need and we must have a Hindu state where Hindu principles and values are the dominant values of the day. And if it means Hindu fundamentalism, fine. They are quite frank in saying that they, you know, the notions of secularism are irrelevant. You know, they want some sort of broadly put Hindu religious state structure, which would be quite different from the secular democratic nation that India is at the moment.
About 83% of India is Hindu.
Right.
What percentage of that do you estimate is fundamentalist? You know, and is part of this movement to make India into a Hindu state?
That's a very difficult question to answer. What I would say is that there is a broad strand of sympathy for the principles espoused by Hindu fundamentalists, by which I mean that they believe that Muslims have been granted privileges which they are not their due, that they have personal law, which is not civil law, which applies to them. For example, Muslims are allowed, Muslim men are allowed to divorce their wives under Islamic law by saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and they are not required to pay alimony or any sort of compensation to the woman at all. It is a form of law that is practiced in Islamic countries, but it is not a form of law that is practiced in secular countries. And many Hindus feel that this is a form of discrimination against Islamic women, and in fact, they are correct about this. They also feel that Muslims have too many children, that Muslims are unethical in their business dealings. I mean, there is a deeply rooted strand of prejudice among many Hindus against Muslims. And you hear it from the smallest village up to the most sophisticated Indians in this society, Hindu Indians. And I hear it at dinner parties, and I hear it when I'm sort of strolling through some god-awful village in the middle of nowhere. It is widely held.
So the intolerance of Muslims is shared by many Hindus, even those who don't count themselves as fundamentalists.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think there is a broad, well, intolerance is perhaps not quite the right word, but certainly there is a sort of lingering prejudice. I mean, you would call it racism if they were a different color. That does not mean that most of Hindu India approved of the demolition of the mosque. I think a lot of Hindus thought this was outrageous. I mean, a lot of Hindus are committed to the notion of secularism and argue, I think, quite reasonably that a legitimate notion of secularism does not include special religious laws for the Muslim community. That is what they find disturbing. They also, you know, India has had a centuries-old history of conflict between Islamic invaders and the indigenous Hindu community. I mean, India's only historical experience with Islam has been one of invasion and looting. And for some reason, historical memory continues to play a very vigorous role in people's passions and people's religious emotions and people's sense of what needs to be done to set society straight.
Is Hindu fundamentalism a relatively new phenomenon?
In its political form, yes, no question about it. It is really a creature of the 20th century. I mean, the group that led proceedings in Ayodhya that encouraged all of these people to come to this place where the mosque was is a group called the RSS. It's a semi-fascist Hindu organization that when they were there, many of their members were destroying Muslim cemeteries. They wear uniforms resemble in some ways the Nazi youth. I mean, they're very much like the skinheads in Germany at the moment. The RSS is the group that killed Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, one of their members killed Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, these people have really flourished since independence, since the partition with Pakistan, because they feel that the greater India, India as it existed under the British Empire, has been broken apart by the colonial masters, the British, who agreed to let Pakistan go its own way, and, you know, Bangladesh separated out later. And so they believe that it is time for them to assert themselves as Hindus. So it is very much a product of post-independence India.
Edward Gargan reports on South Asia for the New York Times. He spoke to us from New Delhi. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.